Welcome to the Learning Can't Wait podcast, a Full Mind production. At Full Mind, our vision is to ensure every child has access to an exceptional education. Each episode, we will be joined by pathfinders within and around the education space who are bringing about transformational change on behalf of deserving students. I am your host, Haley Spierbauer. Welcome back, everybody, to the Learning Can't Wait podcast. Today, I have an incredible guest. We have Dr. Asia Johnson, the Master Principal of Longwood Preparatory Academy in the South Bronx with us. Asia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Haley, for having me. I appreciate it.
It is so important to me that we have a diversity of experience and voices on the podcast, and having school leaders in on the podcast, sharing their experiences, their efforts, their initiatives, and their daily life is so valuable to our listeners. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here.
No, it's no problem at all. I love talking about this stuff. So it's amazing to me how often people want to hear it.
You know, amazing to you is so, it's so funny because as I talked to you, I could see you light up prior to this call when we were just prepping for our conversation, light up when I asked, is there anything of particular interest that you'd be excited to talk about today? And so I just have to say, like, your inspiration, your passion is infectious. And I'm really excited for the listeners today to get a little taste of what I mean when I say that.
Me too.
So Asia, it'd be really great if you could just start us off by telling us how you became the personal and professional version of yourself.
How I became the personal version of myself. I'm not a native New Yorker, grew up in North Philadelphia, had a lot of traumatic growing up issues, and lived in poverty for a number of years, got bounced around from a number of schools and elementary schools. I recounted 7 different elementary schools by third grade. And luckily, I was never held back from school at that time. And I sort of thought about the challenges that I had with having a parent who was not involved in a lot of my education, and just meeting some amazing people when I got to high school, a math teacher who like really believed in me and, you know, saw that I wasn't doing as well and pulled me to the side and said, what do you do after school? Because, you know, you're not doing well in this class. And I had a part-time job at Burger King, and I didn't shift in, start till 4. School got out at 3. She says, stay with me after school and I'm going to help you and tutor you. And she did. She became my favorite teacher. She was the only one who was invested in me and didn't allow me to opt out of math, something I had deemed myself as having dyscalculia then, and I've never been formally diagnosed with it. But and so those experiences I kept with me when I went to college. I worked hard. I was never like a top of my class. I never got offered AP courses. But when I got to high school, something in 10th grade, 10th and 11th grade just really clicked for me. And I was like, you know, I think I can go to college and I think I really want to do it. And I just worked so hard. My 10th and 11th grade year, I started to get some offers, found some interesting colleges to go to, visited an HBCU during my senior year, Delaware State University. And I love the schools, an hour away from Philly. And I went there, stayed there for all 4 years, graduated, and thought I was going to become an attorney. And because I had an English degree, and I was like, I'm not going to be a teacher, because people are like, what are you going to do with an English degree? And I was like, oh, I'm not going to be a teacher, I'm going to be a lawyer. And then graduated, was like, I am not going to law school. I'm going to have to figure this out. But then there wasn't really a lot of jobs for English majors, and I didn't want to do journalism or, you know, of any of that. So I decided to go back to school, got my master's, went into a program called Corporate to Classroom. I was working at Verizon at the time. And I got into this program. It's very similar to like teaching fellows, mm-hmm, or Teach for America.
Career changers, right?
Career changer program.
Right.
And so going into the program, got my master's, I ended up teaching. They were very desperate for teachers. I was my class third teacher in November. So I didn't start teaching until like November, and I was their third teacher, and they were set on getting me out of the class. They were like, "Oh, you're going to leave us like the rest of them." I said, "I'm here." And I taught self-contained special education. I had so many challenges there with like trying to teach the principal about demystifying her understanding of special ed. And just begging for support. I had a classroom that had nothing but garbage in it. It was just like everything that no one wanted was in my classroom where my students were. And so I cleaned it all out. I had to do a lot, and taught for 2 years special education, realized that advocacy for students with disabilities was the thing that I really needed to do. And then I moved to New York City and got a job at a charter school in Harlem. Started that pathway, and it just became the most rewarding thing for me to do is to lead the special education work. And so fast forward many years later to becoming a principal at a turnaround school, I accepted the job of this school without even knowing the name of the school. I'm sure that's probably illegal, but I just wanted to try my hand at being a principal in a New York City public school, which is very different from being in a charter. And the school at the time when I got here had a 40% graduation rate and a 77% chronic absenteeism rate, about a 12% college and career preparatory access for students. So only about 12% of the students actually passed college prep courses, AP courses, College Now courses. And I said, I think I could do this. I had worked with a different district doing special education in the city with students who are living on, who are being educated on Rikers Island in a secure detention facility, some drug and mental health rehabilitation. So I was like, I can go do this little school in the Bronx, right? And they did have a student, the school did have and still does have a 30% students with disabilities that attend the school, about 20% English language learners. And I just learned a lot in the turnaround process of, one, like having kids feel like they're welcome and they're a part of a community, having very high expectations for them. And that sort of blossomed me into wanting to research it, knowing that I was getting all these teachers who had to believe in my mission. And I hired a whole bunch of brand new teachers, like brand new, never ever been in a classroom ever before. They took a chance on me. I took a chance on them. And I figured we would just learn and grow and develop together, which we did. And they were all a part of the turnaround process for the school that has now led us to an 89% graduation rate as of last June, and a 32% chronic absenteeism, and a 93% college and career preparatory index. So 93% of our students pass college and career preparatory courses, AP courses, take college courses during the day. They're dual enrolled. And that work was all a part of who I became from both personally having not experienced that, but going and being in a school, a high school at the time where those options weren't available to students like me, but now working in a school that's very similar and not allowing kids to opt out. Like kids don't get to opt out of access here. So every student takes an AP course. Every student takes a college course, whether they're a student with a disability or they're English language learners. I believe in embedding supports that's going to allow them to be successful, so there is no, you know, Asia Johnson or Dr. Asia Johnson potentially sitting in their classes, and I'm not giving them access to, you know, maybe I would have been a lawyer had I been exposed to more curricular access in high school. And so, you know, I just believe access is not optional for children, and they shouldn't be, especially students of color.
So hearing your story just really emphasizes the importance of education. I mean, you just painted a picture of your personal history and how education and teachers made a tremendous impact on your trajectory. You're now painting a picture of a school that had potential, as all schools do, and with the right community surrounding your students and your families, was able to change the trajectory. So I feel like I need to pause for a second, because what you shared is so meaningful and really emphasizes what this work is about. It emphasizes the need for passionate people who don't believe in barriers. I love the phrasing, access is not optional. I think you just titled our episode here. But wow, like congratulations to you, like, and the community and the team that you built, who unabashedly believe in the potential of students and the work that's required to get there. Incredible.
Thank you very much.
Of course. Let's talk a little bit about the work that's required to get there. Turnaround work is known to be in the education space some of the most challenging work because you're not starting from scratch. You're starting with a community that has experienced what the system calls failure, but often is just a lack of attention, support, resource allocation, and really love that's required to build greatness. So what does turnaround work look like in the beginning, and what does it look like now?
In the beginning, it is very, very challenging. I think it's almost like having a whole bunch of tools to build something, but you don't know where to start. You know, it's being able to identify what is the most important priority that's going to yield the greatest results. Sometimes you need to identify and be patient with yourself around knowing that these things aren't going to change overnight, right? I know for me, it was a lot of pressure because the school when I entered was considered out of time. It was persistently struggling and was out of time. And so one of the things that I had to do was all of the teachers in the building and counselors had to reapply and re-interview for their jobs. That's how much the school had struggled in the past. And so with that, it became, what is the greatest priority? So out of the 23 staff members that were in the school at the time, I only retained 9 out of those 23. I only rehired 9 of those 23. So I had to start there. So now I have to hire a bunch of other teachers and counselors to uphold this vision of excellence. Ones who had high expectations for students, one who knew that kids weren't just here because they needed to be here, but that we wanted them to be here and that we believed that they were going to be successful from being here. And to support that work, we've really started with identifying an instructional framework that we knew was going to help us. We have used the culturally responsive teaching in the brain work from Zaretta Hammond. Since 2018, those practices have lived in our school. They required us to really think about how to get kids ready for rigor. Students who came from all over the city, sometimes even in the Bronx, to let them see the level of excellence in themselves that maybe others had not seen. And to take it even a step further, because our school is very diverse, we wanted to make sure that we were able to put in a set of culturally responsive practices that will allow us to see them for who they are, feel affirmed, be warm demanders for them, as is mentioned in the book, right? Elevate their cultural experiences and give them more challenging work that we knew that when we put those supports in place, they can step up to the plate. When you tell them, my expectation is that you get an 80, right? And here's what I'm going to do to get you there. My expectation is that you're going to take this college class and you're going to pass it. You're going to take this AP course and you're going to pass it. That you have the access to those resources that you create in your school. And so with that in mind, I've created this framework to really think about how do you embed culturally responsive practices by operationalizing, internalizing, and institutionalizing them across every single thing that you do in your school community, right? Sometimes people think of culturally responsive practices, we're reading books by authors of color, or we're talking about people of color, or we celebrate a historical, like we celebrate Black History Month, or we celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month. We have to go beyond that. And what I've seen here is from teachers is that they understand the vision and they also want to be a part of it. And so to operationalize that, first we needed to start with understanding what does it mean to be a culturally responsive school? How do you operationalize it so that when I'm speaking to a parent, it's a culturally responsive conversation? I'm not judging you based on what I think you, what I think I know about you, right? You don't care. You've never come to any parent-teacher conferences. You don't care, right? I'm thinking perhaps you're busy because you have a job in the evening, or you have other children to think of that you have to take care of. Perhaps you yourself might have a physical disability and you can't get access to this building, right? Maybe the time doesn't work for you. Maybe just the way you, maybe your experiences from other schools has led you to feel like you can't trust this school, right? That's being culturally responsive. I've had parents who've hung up on me. I've had conversations with them where they've hung up on me and I called them right back and said, hey, I think we got disconnected. Right. I didn't say, oh, I'm never calling that parent again.
Right.
You know, I said, hey, I think we got disconnected, but I do want to leave you with this. I think that your child can do X. And I believe that if you allow us to continue to support, here's what we want to do for your child. I literally had that same parent call me back and apologize to me because they sent me the voicemail when I called back the second time. And say, I apologize. I'm actually going through something.
Mm-hmm.
I have a young child at home. I have this expectation that my child is going to go to school. They're going to do the right thing. They're going to do what they're supposed to do. And I'm very exhausted. I am tired. I am exhausted. So you calling me to tell me that my child hasn't been in school, is missing school. That's my frustration. I apologize. She's on her way to school. She's going to be late. But if you can please talk to her, if there's any resources you can give to help her stay encouraged and stay in school, I would appreciate that. Now, if I wasn't being culturally responsive, I would just make the assumption that that parent didn't care. I would see the child and say, oh, well, she doesn't care. Her mother doesn't care. Who cares what happens to her? But because I'm operationalizing what I want to become a norm in the school, it happens consistently. When we think about the classroom practices, we've used resources like the NYU scorecard to evaluate how culturally responsive our curriculum is. We're ensuring that it's anti-racist and it aligns with the cultures of the students that are in this school. And then we also ensure that to internalize it, it becomes second nature. You might often hear about people saying that they have equity teams. And it's like, you know, we have a team to make sure that we're doing equity. We're like, but we don't have a team to make sure we're doing reading, or a team to make sure we're doing math or social studies, right? We just have those teams that are talking about how do we strengthen this work. So I said, we're not doing equity teams. We're just going to do the work. We're going to make sure that everything that we do in this school is culturally responsive in our curriculum, in our conversations with students, in our conversations with their parents, in our communication to them. Like just translation of a newsletter is not culturally responsive. It's just translating a newsletter,
right?
It's about how do you celebrate those differences? How do I make sure that I'm communicating to you some of the things that's also important to you and your community? And institutionalizing is how you make it a part of second nature. I call it the brushing your teeth moment. No one has to remind you when that alarm clock goes off that it's time for you to go brush your teeth. You just do it, right? And when it's institutionalized, it becomes a part of the fabric. It's permeated throughout your school community. It is what you do without second guessing. And so that is some of the work that has led us to be able to effectively turn around the school from where it was to where it is now.
But making it part of the fabric, like the way you're saying it in a way more eloquent fashion than I am, which is to operationalize, internalize, and institutionalize this. But I appreciate the notion that it has to be part of the fabric. It's not a lesson you occasionally return back to once a month when you have a staff meeting. It is part of everything you do. It is part of every person you hire. It is part of every conversation you have. It's not something you revisit on occasion when you feel like it's slipping. That is what makes, in my opinion, something institutionalized, part of the system that you're building and creating. And so powerful for students, right? So powerful for students to have a community around them committed to this type of work. I think that there's a direct connection between the systems that you're building, the cultural responsiveness you're embedding, and your high expectations for students and their academics. Let's talk about what you named earlier, your 93% passing of, I'm sorry, I forget the term you use, but the equivalent of AP exams or college readiness exams. I think there's a direct connection there. Let's talk about the decision that you made to have every student receive the scaffolds necessary so they can access the content and be successful.
So interesting enough, I always call it as like my fake it till you make it moment. So when I arrived at the school, we had very low number of ninth graders who had applied to the school. Typically, you should have anywhere between a typical ninth grade class up to upwards to 100, right? We had 26 who had applied for ninth grade. And what was challenging and problematic about that is that you want to sustain the school. And, you know, in New York City, if many of you know, the smaller schools, they just get closed altogether. Mm-hmm. You can't have a school of like 100 students, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I did was I know that parents are most interested in getting their kids into a preparatory school, one that was also a college preparatory school. So just two things that I did. One is I changed the name of the school. I applied for a number of grants so that I can not just have a school that existed for the sake of existing, but I wanted to be able to give kids a specialized program. And so I had applied for a $500,000 career and technical education grant, which I was awarded. I applied for a $65,000 grant, which I was awarded, that enabled students to get make up credits that they had from the past, and also get some counseling as well, have Saturday Academy to help them to recover and feel good. The other thing that I did was I applied for the then Shirlane McLean, Bill de Blasio's wife, had a mental health grant that I applied for $10,000. And I wrote a proposal to open up a recording studio to offer hip hop therapy. And this is the Bronx. So I figured, why not? Why can't we offer hip hop therapy here? I had talented counselors. You know, it went well. I was awarded this $10,000 grant, built a recording studio in the school that was connected to the media program that I also applied for and got the grant for. So now students come to the school. They learn how to create films, do podcasts, do digital communications, and they learn Adobe Photoshop, all of the things that all the celebrities pay for to look good. Our students are learning that is a college ready skill. They take exams that will then lead to replacing a Regents if they need to. We partnered with a number of colleges here, have an articulation agreement with those colleges. So the courses that the students are taking here, if they apply to City Tech, any of the CUNY universities that we're partnered with, they will automatically articulate into that university, and their high school credits will dual count for college credits for them, have they majored in, you know, web design or any of the tech fields that's related to our coursework here. Additionally, I just kept telling parents that this is a college prep school. And in order to be a part of a college prep school, you have to receive an 80 or higher on your English and math Regents. Now, it was hysteria for a very long time where kids were like, oh my God, I can't do the 80. I can't. Oh my God, it's going to drive me crazy. I was like, I believe in you. You have support. Mm-hmm. We had students with disabilities who had intervention that we gave them during the day that did not disrupt their program. We didn't take all of the fun classes. You don't get art. You don't get theater. You don't get, you know, all the fun classes because you know, you don't read on grade level. We found a way to be able to embed it in the day so that they can get best of both worlds. And the students achieve those goals. We partner with organizations, colleges that we knew would want our students to come, local colleges, and say, can you offer a college course right here on our campus? So we got a college to come in, send a professor here to offer a course, 1 3-credit course, intro to psychology, which everybody loves. Everybody wants to diagnose somebody with something. The kids love that course. And they came and taught the course. Our kids from there, they wanted to take more courses. So we started to pay. We paid for Syracuse University. I paid to send a teacher to Syracuse to get trained so he can be an adjunct professor teaching here. I opened up more courses here. We partnered with other organizations. So it just became that part. Then it came to the expectation of every 11th and 12th grade class, English class, will be an advanced placement course. So they are co-taught by a special education teacher and or an English language learner teacher, right? Because we've provided so much support to them in 9th and 10th grade in terms of intervention, reading intervention. If they had it, that I knew by the time they got to 11th grade, they had access to that rigorous coursework. And again, it was not optional, right? Because when we did have it optional and the coursework was challenging, you saw kids say, I don't want to be in that hard course. I don't want to be in that course at all. And I said, no, it's not optional. Access isn't optional. You're going. And I was very clear with parents, when you come to this school, your child must take and get it, receive an 80 on their Regents exams. They will take an advanced placement course. They will take several interim assessment exams during the day, because I want to know, how is my teachers doing with learning, your teaching your child? Where are the gaps in their learning, and how can we use that opportunity to fill in those gaps? And if I only wait until the state assessments are happening, it's too late. The gap is already widened, right? And then when you're very, what I found is that when you're upfront with parents around that time about what's happening, they're more likely to be on board, right? Mm-hmm. And kids are too, because you're making them aware, and you're making learning not be the thing that they want to stand up against, you know, like back up against, especially exams. Kids are so afraid of exams, but we need to normalize that as a process of what we have to do. Even professionally, we have to get a driver's license. If we want to drive a bus, we have to, it's an exam, right? If you want to be a teacher, you got to take a test. If you want to do construction, you have to take exams for everything that you want to do. So we had to demystify that concern that kids had. And so the 93% was as a result of us doing an entire culture shift with our students, our community, our families, and saying, you can do it. We're going to help you. And I believe in you. And here's the access to it. And not cherry picking either. Not saying you can't go into AP because you didn't get an 80 on the Regents. Like, you might not have made the score that you want. You may not. We don't have 100% of students getting an 80, but we have 100% of students striving for an 80, which is a difference, not just passing, which is a 65, right? And so when you change that mindset of kids thinking that 65 isn't good enough, then you start to think about, what are some ways in which I can ensure myself internally that I can do better?
Wow. I know when I heard you first speak about this concept at Longwood Preparatory Academy, it was at an event, and I heard you share that. And I said, wow, I have never come across a school that has that expectation that all kids will take college preparatory courses. And it shouldn't be, I would love for it not to be surprising. I would love for it not to be an outlier, but it very much is right now. And so again, like, absolute incredible kudos and hats off to the work that you put in to make that happen and to build a community of learners and families and teachers and staff who all are driven and passionate about achieving these outcomes. It's absolutely incredible. It makes me so inspired. And I have to book, I'm coming up to the Bronx to visit some schools soon. I really would like to make a stopover.
Come on over.
And see your students in action. We haven't spoken largely about the teachers just yet in this conversation. And my last question for you is about them. So I'm going to tailor the question I normally ask and ask it about your community teachers. So what advice would you give a Longwood Preparatory Academy teacher who's just starting their career at your school right now?
The advice that I would give them would be that it's very similar to like my interview question. And it's interesting, my AP and I always will make our determination about whether or not we want to hire a teacher based on how they respond to the question. And the first question is, why do you want to teach in the South Bronx? And then, what makes you a great candidate to teach at Longwood Prep? But when we think about the response, we are looking for a school that is committed. We're looking for a teacher who is committed, not looking for a teacher who wants convenience. What we know, which answers we get, are, this is close to my house. Or, you know, the train is right here, or I'm right over the bridge, right? Or something like that. And we always clarify that the difference is I'm looking for commitment and you're looking for convenience. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for you to say that the South Bronx is has some of the poorest congressional districts in the country. the South Bronx specifically has a need for a teacher like me. And let me explain to you why. I'm passionate. I'm committed. I believe students of color deserve excellence, require high expectations, require a teacher who can think outside the box, and more importantly, can are in need of a teacher who wants to do more than just only teach English and only English. So help me God. Right. Because the thing about high school teachers is they are subject based educators, right? They're not like elementary and middle, because elementary teachers, they teach everything. High school people are about their content. They teach social studies because they love history. They teach science because they love science. They love exploring and problem solving, right? So when you love your content, you also have to get other children who don't love your content to love your content just as much as you do. Right? Mm-hmm. Or even have the belief that they can do it just as well as you believe you can teach them, while also feeling good about it. Right? Some of the courses that you're going to be required to take here requires teachers to do that. And our teachers here are passionate, they're committed, they're relentless. That's how you think you can get any teacher to teach an advanced placement course to students with disabilities? That you have to have a level of commitment. You have to have a level of confidence, right? And your leader who says, I'm going to support you, and your co-teacher who says, you're going to be able to help me differentiate and provide some scaffolds for some students who need access to this course, right? We're reading Just Mercy. That is not an easy text.
Sure. No.
you know? You know, we are doing some, I mean, AP language is challenging. It's challenging. So if you're an English language learner and you're reading and you're taking an AP language course, you're going to have a lot of belief in your skills as a teacher. And I tell teachers, I believe you can do it. I'm not going to set a teacher up for failure. I'm not going to give you a course that I know you're going to fail at, because, you know, like, why would I do that? I want you to be successful at it. I know that you could be successful at it. I'm going to get you coaching. I'm going to get you textbooks. I'm going to get you resources. I'm going to get intervisitation so that you can see some other schools that have the same exact thing. Because although those students might look different in other schools, that doesn't mean that you cannot teach the same way they teach, but with the students here. And so when you have that belief and the teachers believe, they have that strong self-efficacy, which was a part of my dissertation research, is I wanted to know why. How do you get teachers to have self-efficacy? How can they believe in themselves and their work? And when they do have that belief in their work, they just they teach as if they could teach, they could teach anybody, which they can. You know, you just got to get them to believe that they can. And they have. These teachers have.
Well, Dr. Asia Johnson, it is an absolute honor to be able to amplify the work that you're doing at your in your school community and share the triumphs of your students and your families and your teachers and your staff. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you letting me share my story today.
I feel like I could ask 8,000 more questions, but you're a school leader. I can't keep you more time. I have to make sure you get back to your community. But I know that the listeners that joined us today are probably as enamored with the highlights you've shared and also some of the practical information about building a community that's culture responsive, embedding it in their community and their work, and also continuing to have high expectations for their students and providing the proper supports to make it possible. So thank you so much again for being on, and thank you to everybody who joined us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Learning Can't Wait podcast. If you like what you heard, please rate, review, and share this episode. Be the first to know when we have a new episode by subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to be a guest on the show or have a suggestion for an episode, email us at podcast@fullmindlearning.com.